Sure.
Thank you.
All right, everyone, I think we'll go ahead and get started. Or do you need, do you need a second still, or?
No, I'll just plug it in when they.
Okay. Okay, everyone, well, first of all, thank you for those of you who are here for coming out to the Talk Is On class-sponsored panel, Radical Media in Chicago. I'm Steve Masick from North Central College. I'm going to be chairing the panel and trying to keep everybody on their time limits because we've got a lot of people on this panel. I just want to say a couple things just by way of preface to the topic and why we chose to do this. The Caucus on Class was interested in having a panel that had a local tie-in. And Chicago really has, those of you who are from Chicago, quite a few of you here are from Chicago at some point in your lives, are familiar. It has a really rich history as a site for site for experiments in radical and alternative media, going back to the late 19th and early 20th century. It was home to a really vibrant anarchist, socialist, and labor press. Home to Charles Kerr Publishing Company, probably arguably the most important radical publishing house in the first half of the 20th century, published the first English translation of Das Kapital. It has been, over the years, a home to lots of experiments in radical media of various kinds, including Cartempwin Film Collective, the Documentary Film Studio, Labor Beat Television, the longest-running labor-oriented television show in the country, and In These Times magazine. And the sad thing is that the radical media in Chicago, aside from a few publications and WCFL, the labor-owned radio station, hasn't received the scholarly attention it deserved, and that's why we wanted to have this panel. And so with us to help explore this topic, today we have, I think, a really exciting group of panelists. Some of them are sort of scattered around the room, so I'm just going to go through here and recognize some of them. We have first Larry Duncan from Labor Beat Television. He's the executive producer of Labor Beat TV, and also was up until very recently the editor of UpNet newsletter, which is the newsletter of the big labor media organization, or labor media producers organization. We have also up here Judy Hoffman, who's a foundational member of Cartempwin Films, a filmmaker, and we're actually going to hear some of her films discussed on today's panel. There will be a screening, I need to point out, of Cartempwin Films later today from 2:15, I believe, until 4, and Judy will be there answering some questions with Jerry Blumenthal, who's also a founding member of Films. We have also Tracy Van Slyke, who is the publisher of In These Times magazine, and then last but not least, Angela Aguayo from Eastern Illinois University, and John Becken from Albright College, who up until fairly recently was also the editor of The Industrial Worker, the newspaper of the industrial workers of the world. So we're going to hear first from, we're going to go in rough chronological order. First we're going to hear from John about Chicago's immigrant labor press. Then we'll hear from Angela talking about Cartempwin Films, then Judy, then Larry about Labor Beat, and then Tracy will wrap it up.
And you'll give me a two-minute warning?
And I will give you a two-minute warning.
Okay, so trying to do roughly 50 years of history here in roughly 10 minutes. So
more or less.
Yeah, the basic point I want to make is quite simple. That is to say, Chicago had a very active and vibrant labor press. It was rooted in community institutions, particularly immigrant community institutions, although I will briefly mention some other sorts of media as well. And I think if we look at the ways, on the one hand, these media were rooted in these institutions, in these networks, these communities, and on the other hand, the ways in which these movements structured the media to hold them accountable, to make sure that they were a part of a broader, held accountable to the broader movement, that we can learn a good deal about how we might reconceptualize the work we do today. Although, of course, on some levels, there would remain the issue of that movement. It's not simply that our media are in disarray, there is not quite the movement to sustain them either. And so I want to start with a very simple overview, a very rough overview, of the ecology of the city. And the point I'm making is a very simple one. Chicago is an immigrant city. It's at the transportation hubs of the country, a lot of mass production, a lot of transport, and we have a steady influx of immigrant workers to fuel the explosion in the city's population between 1880 and 1930, and that growth continues well beyond if I were to take it forward. But if I were to take it forward, I'd never finish. So the purple category is the foreign-born, people who did immigrate from other countries. The final category is the children. And if you look at the children of immigrants and the immigrants themselves, better than two-thirds of the city's population is immigrant. And frankly, if you were to go into the working class, it would be a much higher proportion. It's also a city with a fairly diverse press, and I don't mean to say that Chicago's unique in this. Media historians tend to look at very mainstream, a very narrow slice of mainstream commercially supported newspapers, and the work I have done over the years has convinced me that that was not the dominant press model anywhere in the world. But it certainly wasn't the dominant press model in Chicago either. Again, here I'm taking a very narrow slice, and it's a ridiculously narrow slice. I'm only looking at daily newspapers published with the intention that they be permanent. So for example, in 1910, there is a Yiddish language daily that's launched during the garment workers' strike, but it's only for the strike. And then it retreats to weekly publication once the strike's over, so it's not in my data. Weekly papers, not in my data. Most prominent numerically, they're not here, because I'm just taking a ridiculously narrow slice. And foreign language papers are a very major part of the media sphere. It's an actively oppositional press. Within the foreign language press, it's filled with critiques of mainstream journalism. The Arbeiter Zeitung, the German language daily newspaper, Labor Daily at one point, runs an editorial talking about how freedom of the press has become completely prostituted to printing lies and advertising. A distinction that I don't think they really saw, as I think they were being redundant there. And to the Chicago Federation of Labor's official paper, The New Majority, which debuted with an article about how kept press on job for State Street, that's the department stores down the road, and we have cartoons about the kept press and how it's enslaving people. So this is a press that identified itself in opposition to the mainstream journalism of its day. In 1910, we had, not counting the garment strike daily, we had five labor-identified daily newspapers in the city, hundreds of labor-identified weeklies and monthlies. The Daily Socialist, which 2 years later would become the largest circulation newspaper in the city, and because of that would go bankrupt, because in a capitalist-supported media economy, the more copies you print, the more money you lose unless you sell advertising. And advertisers do not care to support socialist daily newspapers for some reason. So you have the Daily Socialist, which is an English language paper. We have the Arbeiter Zeitung, which in 1910 had just switched affiliation from the anarchists to the Socialist Party, was predominantly labor union owned. We had Demi Fossetal, which had its origins in a strike against Spornos, what had been the leading Czech daily newspaper. The typesetters of Spornos went to the publisher and said, we produce the paper, we do the work, we print it, we should own it. And the owner said, what do you mean? And so they struck. And he wouldn't concede the issue, so they founded their own paper, and by this time they actually are the leading circulation Czech language daily in the city. They identify themselves as a labor daily, but they're owned by the typesetters, or in some cases the children of the typesetters. There is a differentiation that's originated, and it's part of the Czech atheist movement in the city, which accounts for three of the four Czech language dailies in Chicago. Zdeněk Ludovi, nobody should trust my pronunciation on any foreign language. My dissertation deals with 29 languages, and I did not have the time to learn how to pronounce them all. Labor Socialist paper published in the Polish community, and then the Czech Socialist daily as well. So we have a fairly diverse body, and it continues. On 1930, actually, the socialist labor press is in decline. because I argue that the Great Depression hit around 1924, 25, if you look at the working class, but certainly if you look at working class institutions, they're in sharp decline throughout the 1920s. But by 1930, we still have these six daily newspapers going on, and several of them do survive for quite some time. Rodnik, for example, while it does not survive any longer, its building is still in use by the Communist Party, the headquarters of the People's Weekly World. So we have a number of papers. These are community-based papers. They are, at the same time, radical, but they are based in the community, not just in their self-conception, but also in their ownership structure. So Arbeiter Zeitung, for example, which publishes the daily Arbeiter Zeitung Monday through Friday, and then on weekends, Verbote and Fackel, as a cultural and theoretical weekly supplements. Their offices served as meeting spaces for community groups. The shares in the newspaper that raised the capital for their printing presses and their type and such were owned by union locals, by singing societies, such forth. Twice a year, the shareholders would come together and they would hear reports on the editorial policy of the paper, on the business policy of the paper, and they would vote on, for example, should the paper move from evening publication to morning publication like the business manager wanted. And the workers said, we don't want to print the paper in the middle of the night. We want to sleep in the middle of the night. So the owners voted no, and they kept the paper as an evening paper. Similarly, in the 1880s, there was a series of elections where people were fighting over the editorial policy of the paper. And it started with sort of a utopian socialist, we will have elections, and then everything will be different, to a more labor-oriented socialist, to anarchists. And I mean, these are, so every 6 months people come, they debate the policies of the paper, they vote on who the editor should be, and with that on the editorial stance of the paper. They also, these community members write for the paper. Much of the coverage of local activities is written by people who are living in those activities themselves. I did put up the commune ad just to make clear, this is a German paper. Some people get it in their mind, it's all ethnic, but it's at least as much class as ethnic. On the one hand, there are other German papers. If you don't want to read an anarchist or later socialist daily newspaper, you could read a Republican daily, you could read a German daily in German, you could read a politically independent daily. You don't have to read the Arbeiter Zeitung. But also, if you do read the Arbeiter Zeitung, you're going to be asked to come to a fundraising event held to commemorate the Paris Commune, which clearly shows that it's not just ethnicity, right? There is some issue of class going on here that transcends, because Germany, of course, was on the other side of that battle. Look very briefly at polls. I'm making two points here. One point, population as it grows, obviously that makes possible the emergence of press to serve it. Second point has to do with diversity of, we tend to talk about there's a Polish press or there's a German press, but there's no such thing. In the Polish community, you have the Polish National Alliance, which is the dominant mutual aid association. You have the Roman Catholic Union, which has a very different notion of what it means to be Polish, a very different notion of class, is deeply anti-Semitic. You have various socialist lodges. They run a people's university, the socialists do. They run singing societies. There's a variety of institutions which, of course, are related to the growth in the overall population. Many newspapers that emerge to serve them, so that at one point in the Polish community, you have a socialist daily, the Roman Catholic Union daily, the Polish National Alliance daily, and an independent daily, all of which argue about what it means to be Polish and what it means to be a Polish worker, and you know, have radically different, they're tied to different institutions, again, processes of election, processes, and not just in the labor press, frankly, the National Alliance also elects its editor. The preceding clip, I did want to, you have the little newsboy, this is from, and he's pushing the picnic. These papers often didn't support themselves, and so they would do picnics and festivals and such where people would literally not just subscribe to the paper, but they would come to these benefits and pay out. This is from a festival that Chicago Federation of Labor organized in Soldiers Field to benefit WCFL. Soldiers Field is the big sports arena at the time, you know, so when you're booking Soldiers Field, it's a major commitment from the movement, right? So the mainstream movement also relied on these sorts of media. And I'm just going to close very briefly then with Chicago Federation of Labor, which had the new majority, speaks to an attempt on its part to displace capitalist dominance of the press, of the political regime as well. They had the Chicago Federation of Labor, which specifically identifies its station as a challenge to corporate control, to advertising control, such forth at the outset. And indeed, they set that station up without a license, in defiance of the federal government, although they do ultimately get a license. And so we have then a press that in many ways defies the capitalist marketplace of ideas. It is a press that is long-lived. Many of these papers last for several decades. Fairly popular, rooted in community institutions, accountable to those communities, but also articulating a different kind of a politics and identifying themselves in opposition, in contradistinction to the capitalist press, which over the same time devotes less and less attention to labor news, less and less attention to covering working class communities, so that, for example, in 1910, the Chicago Daily Tribune, which is a fiercely anti-labor paper, has labor news every day of the week. I got and looked, and sometimes three or four labor stories. They're not good labor stories, but by 1930, three or four times a week there's a labor story in the paper. And of course today, they don't even have a labor beat reporter anymore, do they? Didn't they not replace the guy when he retired?
Yeah, no, he didn't.
So we've had a real transformation. And on some level, it seems to me, if you're going to revive a labor press or an alternative press of some sort, you have to find a way to root it in those kinds of institutions, which provided, on the one hand, financial support, a readership base, but also the stuff of the journalism. You know, they were the community that the press covered. They were the way in which the community communicated with itself. They were organically linked, and I think that is the main lesson that we would want to take from this period.
Angela's up next, and let me just make sure that this is going.
I am getting over a cold, so you're going to have to bear with me a little bit, but I'll try my best to project clearly. Growing up as a daughter of a United Auto Worker in Los Angeles in the 1970s had a formative impact on my life and scholarship. In moments of labor struggle, and sometimes against my mother's wishes, my father routinely brought me to strike lines where I held a sign and shouted chants about workers. I'm not really sure I understood what I was doing then, but my father made sure I understood that things are not always as they seem. At that time, there were very few images on television that looked like my life, people who looked like my father and his union comrades, or stories that dealt with what it was like for your parents to come home laid off from work or to make a difficult decision to go on strike to avoid further exploitation. I can only imagine what would have been like to see our struggle on the television screen, which speaks to the power and the importance of the labor films produced by the Kartikwim Video Collective during the 1970s. This paper is an exploratory stages of a larger project that attempts to understand the visual discourse of authenticity. The basis for appeals to historical and visual authenticity encompass a variety of civic levels and media contexts. In our bustling media ecology, some political narratives are allowed to circulate with the cost of others on the grounds of an implied connection to reality or truth. The visual, a vessel of potential meaning construction, can also mark more authentic narratives through particular forms and cues. A cursory meditation on the contemporary use of handheld camera work in television production, rough documentary framing in fiction film texts, or unconventional or amateur composition in broadcast documentary suggests that the visual has properties connected to the authentic that may have their legacy in grassroots media. In the early 1960s, I'll try to play this. In the early 1960s, heightened political crisis and the development of low-cost video technology created a breeding ground for a new population of filmmakers. The people from the margins were making their own news media, and activists were creating their own media. By giving people access to the tools that allowed them to document their lives and negotiate the world around them on their own terms, the early activist video movement created a vernacular space that countered the prevailing dominant ideology of broadcast television. Video could involve people by making them active participants in their video environment rather than passive viewers in network TV fare. Video's potential was to offer people a variety of viewpoints rather than the official objective one promoted by the network news. The purpose of this presentation is to begin to explore the character of visual discourse, an early activist video movement in the late 1960s and 1970s, through two films produced out of the Carton Quinn Video Collective, HSA Strike 1975, and What's Happening at Local 70. There's diminutive scholarship recognizing the importance of the early activist video movement, and even less attention paid to the importance of labor films during these periods. Precisely what kind of political and visual work does radical labor documentary accomplish during this historical moment that some have termed the guerrilla television movement? There is not enough public materials to adequately assess the political intervention and effectiveness of the Carton Quinn films under consideration. My hope is that Judy Hoffman will touch a bit upon how these films intervened into the process of political struggle and on what grounds. The matter of concern for this presentation is the visual discourse that percolates from the historical and technological conditions in which contemporary grassroots labor films merge. In this presentation, I will argue that the Carton Quinn films like HSA Strike 1975 and What's Happening at Local 70 function to disseminate a distinct vernacular cinematic language. That is, a cinematic language directly connected to and interacting with communities seeking social justice. This cinematic language should be understood in contrast to simply representing interests of marginalized and exploited communities. The markers and cues of this vernacular cinematic language emerge from the social conditions of their production and include visual forms like unconventional framing, anti-slick street aesthetic, and significant focus on public speech as a means to bear witness. The reflection of labor as negotiation and struggle in documentary form, order and organize political meaning and contestation, becoming the basis of shared experience and creating an environment of competing narratives that construct historical, social, and political authenticity. Before moving to the analysis of the text, I want to clarify two important theoretical concepts that are really related to the role of understanding labor documentaries in relation to social justice: the public sphere and the vernacular rhetoric. I understand the public sphere as a theoretical construct that describes the democratic space of civic engagement necessary for social justice. The second, vernacular rhetoric, refers to the voices of ordinary citizens, often left out of the dominant media public sphere, in this case, the citizens of labor struggle. According to Deidre Boyle in her book, Subject to Change, Guerrilla Television Revisited, the activist video movement began with the development of lightweight, affordable, and portable video recording equipment in the late 1960s and early 70s. Although video equipment was developed in the late 1950s, it was cumbersome, stationary, complex, and expensive. The first genuinely portable video equipment, the half-inch reel-to-reel consumer video port-a-pack, was launched in 1968. This gave baby boomers access to the resources to make their own television. This new brand of television, also called guerrilla television, was part of a larger alternative media tide that swept across the country in the 1960s and 70s. For a generation that grew up in the shadows of the civil rights and anti-war movements, television had been the window to the world. Troubled by the political and social unrest of the 1960s, holistically, the movement focused on a utopian program to change the structure of information in American society. Political crisis in conjunction with the technological innovation of video precipitated new visual forms of activist documentary impulse. One of these new visual differences included recording content in streets, meetings, and private conversations, events and spaces that older, clunkier, and more expensive video equipment rarely recorded. These newly recorded environments were also the domain of the working class, and the camera met citizens in the public spaces of vernacular dissent. In these moments, the camera becomes part of the street protest, interacting and engaging with political struggle as opposed to representing it. This produced an anti-slick street aesthetic marked by shaky handheld camera images, out-of-focus segments, beheaded protest bodies, fast and out-of-focus pans, in-camera editing, and various technical imperfections. These films are also marked by unconventional yet refreshing visual framing in the form of unstable close-up shots, center framing, long interviews, sustained shots, and frequent reframing during interviews. If you've gone to film school or taken production classes, this might be not controlling your environment or not eliminating empty space. Many of these impromptu visual markers function to make active video distinct from mass-produced broadcast images. In other words, the image has become the video version of the quintessential zine to the mass-produced magazine text. Not only were these cues and visual forms distinct from the slick world of broadcast television, but they also functioned to create a sense of intimacy, as well as an impromptu portrait of working class struggle. A significant focus of this grassroots video movement is on public speech as bearing witness. Packaged in the form of testimonials and the focus on protest signs, these media texts sacrifice stirring visual content by privileging the speech of the citizens directly connected to political struggle. The liberating potential of this genre is that it gave legitimacy to groups at the margins of society, but also exploded the potential of political potential of documentary by foregrounding ideas and speech of film subjects. As documentary historian Eric Barno suggests, in new focus on speech, documentaries were moving into an area they had long neglected and which appeared to have a surprising, even revolutionary impact. Since the advent of sound throughout the 1930s and 40s, documentaries had seldom featured talking people, except in brief, static scenes. The visual focus is on the very citizens that would not receive a platform in the slick and expensive world of broadcast television. This particular historical moment in grassroots media appropriated unconventional space for public exhibition. Video allowed an immediate playback function, not available through film recording. Early activist video collectives capitalized on this function as a community-building mechanism, screening footage of particular communities in immediate succession of recording them. The portability of video also allowed citizens to use the medium to screen footage in makeshift theaters and community spaces. As C. Travoil suggests, activist video was configured not as a weapon, but as a cultural tool to bring people together. For example, in What's Happening at Local 70, interviews were shot, edited in camera, and screened for 9 weeks at a local bars and restaurants. At the screening, discussions were held about particulars of the labor struggle, and union officials attempted to suppress the viewing of the tape at a Chicago-wide union meeting. But the rank and file workers demanded its screening, and the tape was shown. After the screening, the entire membership voted to support Local 70 at a one-day solidarity strike, and a rally was held. The workers at Local 70 were hired back, but dispersed to other local offices. Video produced a real-time effect, allowing communities to see themselves and the world differently, but in the same speed as broadcast television. As popular publicized narratives about labor unfold in the mass communication industries, which themselves, as Golding and Murdoch suggest, play a pivotal role in organizing the images and discourse through which people make sense of the world, the significance of understanding the visual negotiation of authenticity increases. I'm not suggesting that the 1970s, the visual markers of authenticity in the form of vernacular cinematic language were intentional, but rather a product of technological, social, and political conditions of the time. However, in our current moment, it is possible that the cues of this vernacular language are harnessed as a marker of authenticity. I don't have the time to explore this possibility today. Rather, my focus is on the legacy of vernacular cinematic language in grassroots media. And that legacy is essential, pervasive, and in need of further study.
And now we'll hear from the filmmaker of that film we were just watching, Judy Hoffman.
Thank you. Weird.
It was kind of weird for me too.
We're creating a new space.
Yes, we are.
It's weird. I could talk about Cartempun films. I wrote the history, or I could talk about the process of making political documentaries. What do you want to do?
Process.
We can always talk about, Cartempun, but I'm now working with that, so I have to write things down. Let me see where we are here. So I prepared two things, basically. You know how much Cartempun you could take. So this is, in a sense, just some ideas about what a filmmaker goes through when they try to approach making a film about political issues. In general, when we screen a film, we look at what is considered to be a unified finished product. We consider how film is constructed and how issues and people are represented. However, I believe that we should also look at film as a process involving technology, work, ideology, economics, and a set of relationships between people. Film has a contract with the audience. For narrative feature films, the contract is for quality production values and a certain level of interest in entertainment. For avant-garde and experimental films, the contract is to produce new ways of seeing and manipulating the medium. Because a documentary represents real people within an historical context that the audience recognizes, the audience in most cases accepts authenticity.
Wow.
Thus, the contract with the audience demands what happened in front of the lens is real and or true. I would argue that rather than represent, what we try to do is translate, but that's another issue. So the contract in documentary film is that what happened in front of the camera was somehow real or true. The contract between political film and audience is similar to the documentary. However, I believe it goes further. It calls to the audience for a response to change material and ideological conditions. All film positions itself in relation to the dominant culture. Stages of production are traditionally hidden, but sometimes they can be read in the film. To help us examine how a political film gets made, I will examine the strategies employed and forces at play at each stage of production in a political documentary. First, there is the idea. How do we develop the idea? Why is this particular story chosen? In thinking about this, we have to examine the cultural forces at work, both contemporary and historical, that prompt our idea for such to make such a film. Another question is who initiates the film? In political documentary, often the social actors or subjects involved in the issue seek out filmmakers to make the film. It is then the role of the filmmakers not only to know, but to participate in the issue in a political documentary, as opposed to standing outside in a more traditional type of documentary. One question that we constantly go over is who is the audience? Is there a need for the film? And is there a need based in social change? In making these kinds of films, especially early on, what we would do would take projectors, films, portapacks, videotapes, into communities and show films directly because there were no venues. And we learned from the audience what was needed in these films. And that goes into distribution. But it all, basically when you're a filmmaker, you don't start, it's not linear in a way. You're starting with distribution. You're starting with getting the film out at the same time that you're developing the idea. The other issue that a political filmmaker has to tackle is who are the characters to tell this story? Should there be individuals for people to identify with? Is that a bourgeois ideology? So we tackle these kinds of questions. Then we begin, in a sense, at the same time, dealing with pre-production and research. The question arises whether, to what extent are these social actors involved in the decision-making processes about the film, about what the film should be like. So it's, in a sense, it's this kind of contradiction between being an outsider and an insider that develops. We intend to research not only where we are today, but how we got there, what kind of ideology informs the issue and the film. and do we incorporate that in the film? I know in the initial days of Kartankwan Films, it was far more of a direct cinema approach to letting the story unfold and letting society reveal itself back to itself. And as we became more politicized and we decided to incorporate narration and written narration and historical analysis into our films, along with the verite cinema we were doing, because it needed it in order to tell the story. It wasn't as though things just fell out of the sky. There was a history surrounding it. So we do research, academic research. Clearly, we would hire even research librarians to help us, and academics to inform us. But basically, the real information came directly from the people who were fundamentally affected by the issue. There are no stages really of production per se. You start shooting. It's a cinematic social inquiry. It's a way of not all of a sudden you start something formal that is a film. You're actually researching and shooting at the same time. And in production, I guess one of the questions is who makes the film? The process of filmmaking and the relationships among the crew members themselves is important. Are there, and I don't know whether in seeing a film you read this, what happens among the crew, but my feeling is the more diverse the crew, the better the film is. There's more energy there, there's more input. And essentially the personal is the political, but in a film crew, as opposed to video, there are divisions of labor, and not everybody is equal. So you're needing to negotiate that at the same time. You're in production, clearly your relationship to the social actors are important. I'm using that term instead of subjects, because what's most important is that they have agency, that they're not just there to be mouthpieces for what you as a filmmaker want to say. And then another question is if they are interested in learning film and video skills, is that offered? Is there some kind of skill sharing allowed? When we get into post-production, the thing we also consider is how involved the people are in the screening of the dailies or the footage. Do we isolate ourselves, or do we have them participate in the editing process at certain points when it makes sense in terms of the creative process? As I spoke to before, is the information diegetic, just what is in front of the lens and in the space, or is there commentary by the filmmakers, historical analysis? We consider whether to détournement or appropriate footage, use more experimental techniques. In direct cinema, it was anathema to use narration. Do we use it? Do we also, instead of telling this kind of fairy tale story of people struggling against the odds and overcoming, do we show how complicated it is and make it, in a sense, fragmented and episodic, as in fact these struggles are. The other real question is how quickly to get the film to an audience. In the unemployment camp worker strike, it was like 6 hours. so that again goes into what kind of film do you make, how can you get it out in the world, so it actually has a use value, which I think is very different than what normal film is, which to me is more a commodity rather than to actually have some use. So we're, as filmmakers, we're always doing outreach. We're working with groups And in Cartempan, we were members of the Chicago Women's Liberation Union, arising up angry or really working directly with people. So how you plug into these groups become an issue. How the film positions itself in relationship to existing media. A political film normally tells stories that are not told in the regular media and are not, as I said, commodities, but I have use value, the purpose of which is to galvanize the body of viewers to some type of action. Political mimesis that Jane Gaines talks about, except she uses, in her article about political filmmaking, she uses Rodney King as opposed to political documentary. And as I said, it was, I think, from Chairman Mao, from the audience to the audience. We would take our films out, screen them in small groups, and learn from the audience what people wanted to see. And the real question, is there any way to evaluate these films? You know, as you said, there's very little written about this material. Because political documentaries have been so marginalized in the dominant culture, and by academia as well. And I think one of the questions to ask is now that, you know, we're seeing documentaries and political documentaries theatrically and on television. You know, I really have to question whether the funding and exhibition shifts the way in which we receive these films and what kind of content they have. So, just questions.
All right, next up is Larry Duncan. Yeah, now we connect the audio.
Well, first of all, I want to thank Steve for inviting me, and I'm very happy to be here, you know, with this distinguished panel of troublemakers. And I'm going to try to talk about 2.5 decades of labor television in 12 minutes. I have one good question to start off with, and I think there are two people here who know the answer to this. I think Steve and Jean might know the answer to this, but when do you suppose is the very first labor television show in history, and also in Chicago? All right, well, it was in 1928, and it's mentioned in a footnote in Nathan Gottfried's book on the WCFL. It turns out the chief engineer at the WCFL, the radio station, was this guy named Arnold Schoenberg. Virgil Schoenberg. Virgil was one of these, you know, Philo T. Farnsworth techno geeks, and he was totally up in the most advanced technology, which was television experiments. And he conducted a successful experiment. He put John Fitzpatrick, who was head of the Chicago Federation of Labor, in front of a camera out in Navy Pier, and successfully transmitted an interview with him to a number of different places around the city. In fact, in subsequent issues of the Federation News, he had articles in there which he hoped members, workers, would read and build, go to their local equivalent of Radio Shack and build their TV transmitter. Now none of this happened, but you can see, you know, what sort of, you know, potential parallel universe, you know, there might have been. And, but then, of course, we know, you know, the history of WCFL and what it did, and then finally, along with, I think, you know, the labor movement, official labor movement by the 50s, it's completely, you know, subsided and bought into the idea that, you know, labor and management, labor and capital, we're going to live peacefully together for all time. And this is in the boom. Well, then, in the early 80s here in Chicago, came along the cable TV hearings, and Labor Beat, or Committee for Labor Access at that time, wanted to get in on the ground floor of that and try to make sure that there would be a labor TV channel. There wasn't any specific labor TV channel. The Chicago Federation of Labor was not really interested in that aspect of it, of providing content, pro-labor content in cable TV, but making sure that there were union jobs in laying down the cable. Perfectly legitimate goal. But for many decades, and probably pretty much until right now, that has been their orientation. Likewise, the AFL-CIO, although around that time in the mid-80s, there was something called Labor Institute for Public Affairs. And they set up, you know, some kind of production, but it was, you know, intermittent. And then with the John Sweeney regime coming in, that was jettisoned. And all its media strategy is occasional PR production pieces by, you know, with Abernathy and Mitchell, a PR firm, a pro-labor, you know, button-down PR firm in Washington, D.C. We nevertheless forged ahead and started producing our shows. And I think maybe I'll just jump right now to this clip, because I want to show it so you can have kind of a sense of what we do, and then go back and see how much more I can squeeze in tonight. And this clip asks, it presents two, I guess, points in our compass. And one is a statement, and the other is a question. First, it presents the statement. Is that going to start? We'll find out if the audio is up in a minute.
It's plugged in.
Again, Doc Moselle!
Underlined the fact that the AFL-CIO leadership had no stomach for class struggle. The first step had to be get rid of Kirkland. The crisis of leadership accelerated when, for the first time ever, a militant delegation of war zone workers drove down to Bell Harbor, Florida, where the AFL-CIO Executive Council was meeting. And they demanded to be let into the meeting. They needed the help that should have come long ago. In bad health, Kirkland finally stepped down, and the race was on to fill his job at the top.
Uh,
those of us in the Ohio State Labor Party wanted to get a definitive statement at the assembly, Labor Assembly held in Cleveland in December. The assembly is the highest decision-making body. And we wanted to get it off the table, any idea of anything short of immediate withdrawal, especially a timetable. We cannot imagine jettisoning U.S. law's banner, which says bring the troops home, and instead urging trade unionists to march behind a banner which says bring the troops home in 6 months or anything of the sort. And sure enough, at the assembly, there were voices in opposition to our position. One delegate said, listen, I'm open to a timetable of a few months. I wouldn't want 2 years, but a few months. And our position, of course, is that we have no right, the U.S. has no right to be in Iraq, has no right to occupy the country.
Okay. How much time?
About 4 or 5 minutes.
Okay. Well, you can see that we are able to present a rank-and-file oriented analysis and report on labor news in a way that's independent of the official union bureaucracy in order to do pieces like, you know, in our continual coverage in the mid-90s of the change in the AFL-CIO. We did a number of shows on the split that passes, you know, to the convention floor. I was here in Chicago in 05. Covering always throughout a lot of this now more recently, the labor and the anti-war movement. And this has to do with our practical foundation. We very early on, you know, going back to the 80s again and setting ourselves up, understood that we were going to need to function and operate on a nano budget. And we've seen labor TV shows around the country, you know, start out with the idea, you know, raising tens of thousands of dollars, you know, to make this budget. And they, there was one up in Wisconsin that went for 3 shows. And then, so our design is more, you know, along the lines of, you know, nano, guerrilla production, pretty much based along the line. The lines of a of any kind of rank and file organization, which doesn't have a big budget. We define also our patron is the rank and file in the unions, and occasionally, and to our amazement, sometimes unions and second echelon union officials and so forth. We just recently got a nice hefty donation from the United Mine Workers of America. We did a piece about the dedication of the Verdon Monument. In Southern Illinois, and also from Teamsters Local 705 and the Springfield AFL-CIO Labor Council. So in other words, our starting point is not to analyze and attack and take apart the conservative bureaucracy that keeps on moving more to the state corporatism like Andy Stern and this, you know, labor management, you know, togetherness that he's been pushing. That's not our starting point. Our starting point is, you know, to cover the labor news, to present the most favorable light the labor movement, for, so that it can build and win struggles. And if through the course of that, through the telling the truth about this, we butt heads with union officials, and that's what happens. And we're able to do this because of how we figure out, you know, anticipate our cash flow. Likewise for grants, we very early on gave up, you know, getting grants because you'd have to answer all these questions. We knew very early on that we would not have to put up with that or subject ourselves to that sort of inquisition. So our position is, you know, we don't need their stinking money, and we go on our own. I guess very briefly. What are our venues? We have our show here in Chicago. Very shortly, it'll be in Evanston, Rockford United Labor, AFL-CIO sends us, you know, money every month because we have 2 shows out there. St. Louis City, St. Louis County, and then the Illinois side. And then we anticipate pretty soon Springfield, roughly Peoria, and then for some bizarre reason, Princeton, New Jersey. And then other outlets are Free Speech TV. Occasionally we have a show up there. There are a couple shows over here, by the way, to invite you to grab from the table. Penthouse of Heaven was recently on Free Speech TV, and our most recent one was actually showing this week, The Rise of the Anti-War Soldier. There's another CD on there, just very briefly, that's Union Producers and Programmers Network newsletter. And that is, on a national basis, the fight to develop labor media. You can read in there our discussions and debates with the AFL-CIO, now Change the Wind, about the need to develop a national labor media strategy and so on. But I think, you know, that's sort of an ending point. Is, you know, we can go on endlessly about this, but I'll just end there and, you know, try to answer any questions we have later. Thanks.
All right, finally we'll hear from Tracy Bonslife, the publisher of In These Times, and hopefully that will work. Do I need to change the source here?
Probably.
Yeah, all right. Let's see.
We're all individuals,
oh, there you go.
Got it.
Should be.
What's a good I haven't used a PC in so long. What's
okay.
Where
what do you want to do?
All the way down.
Okay. Well, I'll just explain real quickly. I'm the publisher of In These Times magazine, and we've got to hear from great, like, different academics and media producers. I'm kind of combining those two things in what I've been studying over the last couple of years. As a media producer, I've been trying to study the actual current progressive media landscape and what it's going to look like in the future. And I've done this in a couple different ways. I call her my partner in crime. My co-worker, Jessica Clark, and I have kind of studied this movement. Through a couple different articles. So I'm gonna I don't need to explain In These Times. If you want, I can.
Promote the website.
InTheseTimes.com. So I'm gonna go back to the last one. There we go. Great, thank you very much. This has been a pretty amazing paradoxical time for independent media right now. New technology is really pushing the world of blogs and citizen journalism, online video, and new media production projects. So it's really kind of shaking up how we kind of think media is produced in this world. And it's also shaking up kind of the world of financing media, as well as a lot of people in this room probably know. So while we have this like wealth of information now, we're really poor in capital. So many independent media outlets are in major financial trouble. For example, like Air America declared bankruptcy earlier this year. They're a big for-profit. You know, they were just bought out by this individual guy, this savior that comes in. It doesn't happen very often as someone who's going to come in and pour millions of dollars into one particular media outlet. Another example is there was this organization called the Independent Press Association that was around for the last 10 years. It closed its doors in January, and this was an organization that was providing intense infrastructure support for all sorts of different magazines, and it is now gone out of nowhere. So not only are we struggling to figure out how to reinvent our own individual outlets, we're trying to collectively figure out how to survive in this kind of new media environment. A lot of mainstream media is going through this as well. But there are organizations that are coming together to find these solutions. And for one example that I'm a part of, I'm a staff member for as well, is called the Media Consortium. The Media Consortium was formed based on the premise that to continue to produce strong independent journalism to increase our overall impact and to achieve sustainability, which is key, individual organizations must start working together. So this is the first time in a long, long time, or if ever, that national independent progressive media outlets are working together both on the business side and the editorial side, to share information, to figure out where to coordinate and collaborate. And in many ways, this is a revolution of how we do our work. I think the reason we started doing that was because we were in response to what we call the conservative media machine. This map was the first map that came out of Jessica and my research along kind of what is the landscape now, what are we fighting against? And one of the big things was this kind of conservative machine that was hitting the mainstream media and dominating both national and social kind of politics in the landscape quite a bit. And we wanted to figure out how that was working and why. So this was something, it was part of an article we did called Making Connections. I'll just kind of walk you through this map real quickly. So this was in 2005. I don't think this has changed that much. The right wing has had 40 years to deliberately plan and fund both idea generating institutions, just like walk over here, what we call framers and think tanks, message makers, like the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute, a slew of message disseminating organs, which have grown to include conservative magazines, newspapers, pundits, book publishers, bloggers, radio stations, and of course our favorite, Fox News. The infrastructure also allows for incubation and testing of ideas and talking points. Once such terms are hammered out, they get deliberately filtered through the system. They appear in a variety of conservative outlets, from the Weekly Standard to the Drudge Report, to the columns of conservative commentators, to generate buzz. Eventually, these talking points jump the species barrier into the mainstream media, or what passes for it. This system is augmented by the efforts of these right-wing watchdog organizations, little doggies there, which bark whenever they hear reporting that doesn't fall into their own line of ideology. It's also much more convenient through the consolidation of media corporations and ownership. So they are top-down, extremely well-coordinated, and well-funded. That's one of the big differences, is that on the conservative side, they're willing to pour lots of money into both media and these message-shaping organizations, while on the progressive side, they are much more unwilling or don't know how to operate in that system. and so, on the progressive side, we did a visual representation as well, and this one is 2005. So, and this is what we found. Overall, in comparison to the conservatives' top-down coordinated model, progressive media had been slow to create its own infrastructure. So we've seen the success of the right wing to get their message and people out, and we needed to mimic their success without mimicking their tactics, in my opinion. So in comparison, I would say, is that the comparison of the conservatives' top-down coordinated model, the media network for progressives was ad hoc and horizontal. We talked about the money issue. There are a lot of gaps I won't get into unless you want me to in the Q&A. There are a lot of places where people weren't communicating with each other, both within their own kind of spheres and across their own spheres. So while there was a lot out there, people weren't kind of connecting with each other at the right points. And there were oftentimes people competing against each other. You've got a lot of grassroots, different organizations competing to get their message out versus all the people in DC who, and they don't talk to each other. In fact, the DC people generally try and look down on those people. So that was a big issue. And then a lot of people were, I would say a lot of the grassroots organizations don't work with the progressive media, which is a major kind of fault line in how we continue to impact the national discourse. So we've seen some changes in the last couple of years. As progressives, I think we thrive on debate that supports a diversity of opinions. So instead, we're going to create a model that's collaborative, that's opt-in, and in contrast, is not always about ownership, but is about organizing across and within different media outlets and models. So this is about finding our common interests and working together to strengthen the progressive media network. This is also about allowing people to use all sorts of new technology and digital media, such as podcasting, streaming video, and blogging, to reach new audiences and younger audiences. This is really being seen on the internet and through different ways of distributing content. All this energy is being built to reach the 21st century audience, one that is technologically savvy, one that is looking for tailored media. And with this advent of technology, the audience is not only interacting more with the media, but is also shaping the media through feedback, action items, and is able to create their own media with blogs and podcasts and so forth. All this is impacting the models of old or traditional media, from producing content to their business planning. At the same time, with the birth of new models, many are conceiving new modes of distributing content and creating new business models or adapting old ones. So I wanted to show you, this is another thing. In my mind, as a media outlet, you cannot just be one thing anymore. You can't just be a content producer. As a publisher in these times, I also have to be a strategic communicator. I have to know what's going on in the media reform, media policy movement, to both report on it, as well as to understand how it impacts my own work. So just wanted to show you, this is what I've kind of mapped out as the five different areas of kind of the media landscape. There's independent media content production, strategic PR campaigns, media distribution, media accountability, that's the watchdogs on our side, media policy reform, and we're all working together for political and social change. So no longer can you be just in your own isolated silo. You're having to take on all these different components of work to actually be effective. So benefits of this approach. You can identify and counter right-wing spin, communicate progressive narratives and values. You can develop innovative distribution methods that rely on organizing over ownership. And if people want me to explain that, I can. Utilize new communications technologies that appeal to a rising generation of progressives. So this is where we're at today. First of all, we're in color. Whole new difference. So this is a map we did in 2006, during the summer, that really details out the different types of organizations that are part of this network, how they work together to spread information and create action. It walks viewers through the different ways the Progressive Media Network is working to move issues and experts to new audiences. If you go online, it's very cool. This is actually in Flash. So some of these things kind of walk you through step by step, these two different areas. Maybe I just think it's cool, but it's okay. So tracing, we use the issue of network neutrality here. Does everyone know what net neutrality is? Yes? Okay. We kind of traced how the issue of net neutrality has moved through the system to really hit both the mainstream media and ultimately the politicians who had, you know, the ultimate decision vote on what happens with net neutrality, starting with these different different organizations who are on the ground kind of watching this, like the media reformers. We're connecting with different people like the media watchdogs, different newsmakers like MoveOn.org, and local groups like Chicago Media Action. And they started shifting this debate through their own action campaigns, the own media they were producing, along with connecting with independent and progressive media outlets. So they had like multiple ways that they were getting this information out on multiple platforms through both action items and you know, offline and online kind of work, which hadn't really been connected before. And then moving that into the system of the mainstream media to start reporting on it, who then start hitting a mass audience and moving into the Democratic voters, the progressive base, as well as, I would say, the right wing was started understanding this whole issue and how it affected them, and then hit the politicians. And they were shocked. They had never, this was an example of a campaign around media that people had never seen such energy around before. So it stalled it for a while. That was pretty cool. So one of the main differences that I noticed within the Progressive Media Network in this year compared to last year is that people are actually talking to each other more. I especially see coordination happening with in their own spheres. So this is, and the Media Consortium is an example of that. Yeah, I'm almost done. So, and in order to shape the news instead of responding to it, progressive organizations and media outlets need pipelines for moving stories, reporters, and experts into each other's outlets, as well as into the agenda-setting media, unfortunately, like the Meet the Press. But at the same time, we have to utilize the power and reach of the progressive media itself. So the end goal of infrastructure building is to develop a sustainable progressive media network, combining print, radio, television, video, film, and online projects that can inform and influence public opinion, encourage grassroots action, and create political change. But to do so, media outlets and media-focused organizations need three things: support from each other, which hasn't always happened, financial investment in core journalistic efforts, and communications work and business models so we can be profitable, and the strategy for moving into new digital media that facilitates rapid response initiatives and audience interaction. So I'll stop there.
We've got some time here for, and it was my hope that we would have some time here for discussion and questions. If the panelists would go up there, that would be useful.
Make it square.
Anyone have any questions? Let's go to Pat.
Speak loudly, please.
Yes, speak up.
I do have a question, but I also want to pass out these flyers from the Congress on Class for the remaining panels and screenings, including one of the participants and films that we can see. And to invite any of you who are not on our listserv for the Congress on Class, speaking of Progressive Media Networks, that we might be able to pass around a sheet, and if you want to put down your name and your email address, and you'd like to be added, that would be terrific. We're having a panel on the crisis in academic labor that's going to specifically focus on media reform at 4 o'clock this afternoon, so we can continue the discussion here. But my question is really encompasses what a number of people have said, and starting with the presentations on Templin and kind of the discussion of the vernacular image and the media and the political film. And I was and interesting seeing like what was happening at that time, which kind of echoes sort of some of the new media, you know, online efforts now. And so my question is, given especially young people and their reading of images and sort of they're being so used to really sophisticated images. Do you think that that the idea of the authenticity, right, that's tied in with the kind of images, you know, which I really like with both of your presentations there, is something that for the new generation of you know, young people that they see that as kind of like, well, you know, they're so used to slick images, you know, is there, is YouTube, you know, kind of bringing back people doing their own production and sort of those less sophisticated images in a way that might be relevant, even though it's definitely not necessarily so political? Is it with the new technologies that can make more sophisticated images that there's a new vocabulary emerging? Do we need to be slicker in order to, you know, what are the strategies as far as involving people in the political, you know, content and discourse? So I guess it's just kind of like, you know, taking the great work that's been done, what does it look like in, you know, the current century? And then the last presentation obviously picked on, you know, the need to use all of those different media channels in order to do that.
Well, I'm working on this as a larger project, and I would actually argue that mainstream media has started to mimic these vernacular images. You know, look at television shows, they're shot in handheld cameras now. You see documentaries using the same kind of very rough kind of framing. Big budget fiction films mimicking this kind of very rough kind of production as a way to communicate a sense of authenticity that's actually false.
Right.
you know? And so I think what I would say is that the legacy of those things is likely rooted in what Cartemquin and other film collectives were actually doing at this time. And I would, on top of that, say something that might sound a bit contradictory, but I'm hoping to work out, is that we have a very sophisticated visual palette now. And so I think that it's really important to kind of study how this type of vernacular image is working. And I do think things like YouTube are taking off based on this kind of authenticity and the kind of framing. So I think both things are going on. I think the slick isn't necessary. And yet it communicates something that's being picked up by a variety of media outlets.
So therefore, it's almost like, what's the relationship between form and content? How do we make sure we continue to have a political and radical form?
Yeah, and I would argue that I don't believe that you have to have that vernacular aesthetic to be political in a film. It's a strategy. And for people, and when you made films, was just a kind of product of the time,
there were no film schools, thank God.
Yeah, thank God. Yeah. That was all in camera, too. That was a beautiful piece, all in camera.
Yeah, it was, Cartemquin really did films. I came in to do video and train and teach them video. But I think what you see, and it's a contradiction in media, the thing going in two different directions, in a sense, if you're a filmmaker, whatever, this idea of craft enters into it. And you tend to try to get things to look better. Okay? And at the same time, Hollywood and those forces are going, we're trying to make things more crafted and, you know, narrative in a way. And they're going in the opposite direction. But when we first started out with video, it was new. There were no film schools outside of USC and maybe Columbia College here in Chicago. I'm sure I'm missing some, UCLA or something. So we had to teach ourselves and this accessible new technology. So what you're seeing, a lot of it is just sloppy filmmaking, frankly, because we didn't know what we were doing. However, there were things that were I come out of the guerrilla television movement, that things that we didn't talk about strategies. We talked about, we didn't have that terminology then. What we did was we decided, hey, we have a microphone, we have to get close to a person, you know, even with that huge shotgun microphone, that Sennheiser 804, I didn't know what I was doing with it. I thought I had to deal with this. You know, you still have to be 2 feet away, you know. But we decided it was okay to have a mic in the frame and have the person in the frame, that our being there was also part of the story. We didn't try to hide it. But I think, you know, right now, I think besides YouTube, you should look at mediaburn.org, which is a website of videotapes made by independents. And I think, I don't understand really in the census term new media in terms of production. I mean, because there's still cameras and, sound recorders. What we have is a different way of disseminating information over the internet. And at the same time, you have the democracy of people being able to post it. This was very similar to what we thought of in the guerrilla television movement of trying to make all, information accessible and free. And so this is kind of like a culmination in some way. The ability is here to do it now. Whether the information is, is perhaps there's too much information for people to slog through, I'm not sure, but it's certainly an outgrowth. If you look at Schamburg's guerrilla television manual, especially the meta manual part, it really outlines this entire push towards putting information out there in a kind of ecosystem.
Jocelyn?
I was just struck by the kind of generational difference that Judy and Larry talk about. Radical media is located very firmly in social movements, but it's like socialist labor, women's movements, and Tracy seemed to me to be talking much more like as a business model, and so you separated these different areas of like production, distribution, mm-hmm. and so on, while Judy was saying, well, distribution is something you begin with and you kind of end with. And so can I guess the question is really to Tracy as a radical media maker right now, what do you sense is your connection with a social movement?
I'm involved in lots of different kinds of media movements. I've been very connected to different kinds of community organizing, to progressive communications work. But I came this as at a format as progressive media in a lot of ways is not only getting squeezed, it's could die in its current in a lot of its current format. And so I look at it from, this is part of the movement, this is part of how we're trying to get our stories out, so I'm trying to close these different gaps that I see within the kind of the larger progressive movement from a media lens, if that makes sense. So when I talk about infrastructure, I don't really think of myself as a business person, so it like sounds very weird, but I guess that's my role now as a publisher. But I think of it as a way of figuring out how to not only survive but thrive, to help support different kinds of social movements, political movements, grassroots to the national political landscape in the DC world. So I see it as a tool, and I see it as an important resource, but I don't see it as like, you know, this like thing that we want it to turn into a corporate entity at the same time. So does that make any sense, or do you want me to clarify?
Well, you know, it's similar, I think, to what you go through in filmmaking. I mean, Larry, you know, does it because he has support, in a sense. People are funding. Mm-hmm. But when you don't have that, it's like political filmmakers are caught. I mean, I think what happened is with this kind of culture industry and with all of these foundations, it's like, if you're a community group at this point and you're trying to get some money to hold an event, you have to create a board of directors, and you have to mimic this model in order to go to the MacArthur Foundation, mm-hmm. the cultural arbiters, who will then hopefully fund you. So you have to, it's a very frightening and dangerous contradiction that we're involved in of, you know, what we do to try and support progressive media and how it's been institutionalized.
Yeah, I would say that, like, you know, for example, the reason this, the whole thing for this started is, why is the right wing has gotten so powerful in terms of how they're impacting the national political and media landscape? And it comes down in a lot of ways money, because on the right wing side, they're willing to pour tons of money in. On the progressive side, they will not fund anything ideological. So they will not.
The right
and they
have an
certainly
ideology.
Will not fund ideological media, even though we're producing journalism, or we're producing work that's advocacy journalism. They won't do it. And I've had many conversations with them, many conversations with different kinds of media. So how do we create an infrastructure where we support ourselves and understand how we're operating together? And that's my real focus. So,
Larry, you wanted to say something?
Yes. I think that what you need also is to address the private ownership of the media industry, mm-hmm. and also the class that runs and controls basically public television, that the independent producer, we believe, first of all, is never going to be independent in the sense of being neutral. Mm-hmm. We don't pretend to our audience that we are neutral, that we are partisan, and that I think the rest of the independent media community has to realize that it needs to be partisan. And what we think is, you know, the fundamental conflict, the class struggle, mean ownership and the means of production, and those who sell their labor. But regardless of what you think the political analysis is in society, there needs to be created a political battering ram to end the private ownership of the media and public television. And this means also in Congress, a political party that overthrows this. Not only Republican, but I don't think you're going to find in the Democratic Party what you need to have to happen in public television and in the media, because they will defend the private ownership of the networks and MSNBC and so forth. That means that you have to not only see yourselves as auteurs and producers, but also as a part of a political movement. And it means, you know, revolutionary change, folks. And I don't think you're going to be able to have it, you know, any other way to get this to happen.
Yeah, I just want to thank the panel for a very stimulating discussion. And my question is for Angela. I just want to delve a bit further in this cross-fertilization between center and periphery that Patricia started talking about. And we already talked about appropriation on one end, you know, of mainstream appropriation of this vernacular aesthetic. I just wonder if there's appropriation on the other end, you know, in terms of mainstream influence on this vernacular aesthetic, if there is any. And I'm thinking about, like, mainstream Hollywood texts, well, not very mainstream, but films like Medium Cool or whatever, if there's any kind of appropriation on the other end that had, you know, by the producers of this vernacular aesthetic.
Meaning, is mainstream appropriating which way?
No, I'm sorry, if the vernacular aesthetic doesn't just pop up on its own, if it also kind of reinterpreted mainstream strategies in its own way to create its own sort of look.
Can you give me an example? I'm trying to get a handle on what you're asking.
Yeah, sure. No, I mean, I think, so we've already talked about how there's a mainstream appropriation of this vernacular aesthetic, right?
Yeah.
So if we go backwards, if the vernacular aesthetic appropriated anything from the mainstream.
Of course, if you could just look at popular, mass-produced, theatrical-released political documentary that's evolved in the last 10 years, that's exactly what's happened.
Right.
You know, beginning with Mike Moore and his kind of appropriation of slick, you know, Hollywood-based. I mean, you go from Roger and Me to Fahrenheit 9/11, and you got a radically different aesthetic.
Right.
You know, you get Super Size Me, you get Robert Greenwald hits the stage, you know. I mean, all of these things, I think, are taking what is supposed to be political documentary, activist documentary, and appropriating very slick, kind of Hollywood-esque, kind of forms of cinematic language. Now, the distinction I would make is that there's a difference between representing marginalized interests and interacting and becoming a part of, you know, and that's what I want to make a distinction between what's going on in the 1970s, where the camera becomes a part of the protest, versus what's happening with popular documentary, where there is a simple representation. And then you got people saying, well, how can Michael Moore speak for the working class? He's not the working class anymore. How can these big films, like, how can Morgan Spurlock speak, you know, to grassroots marginalized communities? Like, it, in some ways, you know, the political effectivity, I think, gets lost on some levels.
It's curious, in Hoop Dreams, that Cartunquin did, I didn't work on it, section the a friend of mine called and asked when we started moving into making narrative features. Didn't understand that this was not a fictional film. because of the narrative structure of it.
Right.
So, You know, and then if you talk about what affects what, there's not this Hollywood out there. I mean, if you talk about medium cool, Haskell Wexler started here in Chicago as a cameraman for Encyclopedia Britannica Films. So he was very familiar with shooting documentaries. And so he becomes a great DP and directs medium cool. So it's like, it's not like you jump into Hollywood without any skills or having worked in film in other formats. Right. So
I think it's interesting, the interrelationships.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I would think that the difference between the documentaries that you're studying, the documentaries, the mass scale, the political documentaries now, is the difference is what you pointed out, Judy, is who is the audience? And who are they producing these documentaries for? Is it for a grassroots movement, or is it for a larger middle-class mainstream audience? And I think we know the answer on that one. And then also, I think Greenwald really exemplified, you know, what I think had been happening in different places, but he kind of mainstreamed it as the kind of a distribution model. He didn't necessarily go for these kind of film theaters. In fact, he avoided that. I had long conversations with him around this, and what he really focused on was how to do these different house parties, how to connect with churches, and all that kind of stuff. So I think that's a major interesting new wave of how
that organizing of audience is actually, that is a critical question, and it's one I know labor would be had to engage with. But it goes all the way back. It's always been a problem that you can't simply make your media and it's out there on some equal footing where people just don't, you have to organize the audiences, because the distribution centers, they're controlled by capitalist interests who are trying to make profits. You have to sell your newspapers if you make newspapers for more than the capitalists sell their newspapers for, because you don't have the advertising. So you have to actively organize audiences if your media are actually going to reach people and have a chance of mobilizing.
You know, it's curious, but in these days of like early filmmaking, video making, and I think it might even be true today that for these kinds of political documentaries, we're almost more similar to experimental films in terms of creating exhibition and spaces and creating, trying to, a relationship to the audience. So,
And the technology is totally driving.
Josna could speak to that.
Right? Which have to look like, slick enough to make it into the theater.
Slick enough, and also, of course I haven't seen it, but it's not going to stop me from talking about it. the white people bringing technology to these poor people, and,
and
that these mothers are not, organizing. I mean, it's like, It's this fantasy of Rudyard Kipling world that we have a tendency to see. And also this narrative of, a film about someone overcoming stuff, and then we can pat ourselves on the back because we sat through 3 hours of watching the other be strong amidst adversity. That's not political filmmaking.
Right, but that's what gets
it's colonial
filmmaking today, right? And then the ambition becomes to make it into a theater so you can reach the masses, right? Who will do nothing.
Which
the theater.
But pat themselves on the back because they're good people because they saw.
So anyway, I just wanted to make a connection there and say that I think this notion of politics too has become part of the problem, right? That you get to be political enough for doing that the most.
It's politics as consumption, right? Like, I consumed this film, so that means I am an activist in some way. And that's the problem
it's
with this.
Cannibalism.
Yeah, this mass marketing, which, you know, is what I've been working on, is trying to kind of come to a new definition of what activist documentary means, you know, that it's not about the ideology of the filmmaker, the content of the filmmaker, which is often how it gets characterized in most media covering it, but the kind of spaces and the democratic possibilities and the possibilities for social change that get opened up through the film.
I had an interesting example. This is a non-political film, but it's called Four-Eyed Monsters. Did you guys? Anyways, but it's you know, these two kids, like, decided, like, they met over the internet, and they decided they were going to do a documentary about how they were falling in love. Wonderful. But, so they started shipping it around all these different film festivals, and, you know, it was getting around, but it wasn't, you know, creating that big of a splash. And they're like, you know, if this movie's going to die that we spent 2 years making, and, like, once these film festivals are over, what are we going to do? And so they created this website where they started doing these different, like, chapters of them, like video chapters of them going to these different film festivals and their experiences. And they had 3,000 people watching these video chapters within 2 days, the same amount of people that had watched their actual documentary over these 9 months of film festivals. And so they continued to do this. And then what I thought was really interesting, because I think people rely too much on technology as the answer instead of a tool, like I was saying, is that they started saying, using Google Maps and saying, okay, where do you people live and where do you want to see the documentary? And so they would find, they could pinpoint 300 people in one community that said, we want to see this documentary here. So they started going after their theaters, and they convinced their theaters to start showing these documentaries, this documentary. And like, and then because the theaters got so packed, they kept extending the stay. So I think there's an interesting model to think about when you're thinking about kind of obviously redistributing political documentaries, but how can the audience be involved in bringing those documentaries or films to you, or those media products to your community? How can they be like actively involved? If they're not actively involved in the creation, they're actively involved in making sure they can consume it and get it out to other people.
We have time really for one more question. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is a question mostly for Larry, although John could also chime in. It might be cool too. You had briefly talked about in your remarks about the fact that leadership within various labor parties or labor coalitions will be like react to something like a labor, like the idea of a cable labeled labor channel or WCFL, labor's own radio networks or radio stations. They'll regard them like they're like they're the plague or something. Well, they'll just try to avoid them and try to focus on other things. And yet, at least in my opinion on these things, I can see nothing but advantages to supporting this. And I guess my question is, why do you think that various factors within the labor movement are reacting with such either fear or indifference to the setup of such institutions?
I'll stand up over here. We've talked about this a lot, we kind of gravitate toward the idea that organized labor is part of the political outlook that it has. That it believes that it doesn't need to be politically independent. It doesn't need its own independent weapons or tools to fight. Therefore, it doesn't need its own political party, a labor party, a workers' party. It can work within the existing capitalist party structures, and as an extension of that thinking, it doesn't need its independence regarding the media. It can depend upon, hopefully, some liberal television shows through press releases to get its message out. And if need be, it can hire a PR firm in Washington, D.C. to make PSAs and a campaign. And so that is the best explanation to describe a completely illogical stance, plus the fact that I think once that, you know, labor television gets going, it tends to get out of the control of the bureaucracy. There are some changes, however. Houston Justice for Janitors campaign, which is part of SEIU, did a lot of stuff on Google Video, and they felt that through that campaign and strike, it was helpful. So, by the way, go to Google Video, search for Labor Beat, and you can see some of our stuff in there, and we're passing on.
There's a lot of issues here.
Really quickly, just like
there are contradictions within the movement that we have to understand. So like the New Majority was a paper that commanded a lot of support from the leaders of the CFL, but it also exposed contradictions within the movement, where some people were more committed to an active movement building, some people were more committed to administering contracts, some people were fighting rank and file movements. If you have strong labor media that are integrated into their community, you bring a lot of those contradictions to the fore, and it's often easier to just shut them down. It's often easier to remake New Majority as Federation News and just have, you know, grip and grin photos. And since nobody reads the paper, it can't make waves, and you don't have to then engage in the struggles within your ranks about what kind of movement you're trying to have.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Steve. For a
thank
great
you.
Talk.
Do you want copies of the last map? They're over there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.